To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
She's up in Virginia.
That explains. Cause you just look all calm, cool, and collected. When I, my daughter, and I loved it when my daughter was little, but I'm like,
no sleep.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, gentlemen, this is a goodbye to Billy for a while.
Oh,
we're gonna miss you.
Why?
I'm going to Texas for work for a little bit.
What part of Texas?
Texas A&M.
Oh, cool.
Damn straight. You know that's where I came from, Texas.
Nice.
Yeah. He's worried he can't find nerds there.
Oh, I came from there. You're gonna be okay.
Well, I only heard that there were steers and queers.
No one thinks they're gonna come from Texas.
They say that, but they're not very accepting of the second.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, geez.
Welcome to Two Dimension Comics. Welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode
or no warning.
This is episode number
147.
And I'm your host, Dallas Busha, and we have a massive roundtable today. With me today is...
What's up, guys? It's Rook.
Don. Oh, Don.
Al. Ash Browns.
And that's it. We got a big packed episode for everybody, and as you no doubt just heard, they didn't know that I was recording them. This is one of Hash Brown's last time on the show for a while because he's going up north.
North.
Well, west.
West.
He's going out west, west. Son.
Well,
everything's
north
more to us.
Yeah. Yeah, so fuck you. So, gentlemen, how's it going? It's been a long time since all of us have been together. A really long time.
It's been a while. Awesome.
Yeah, it really has been. It's nice. You guys have been holding down the fort a little bit. Rook actually, you know, did a couple episodes without me, which I was shocked.
I know. Holy crap.
Really good episodes without me, too.
Yeah. We were very happy with those
episodes.
They were
action-packed and exciting and everything.
I had to make Rook and Billy swear a vow of silence on this episode about Deadpool, so I'm sorry, everybody. I'm seeing it tomorrow morning.
There's no Deadpool talk, guys. Sorry.
Oh,
somebody's delayed
ready.
In seeing it.
I was ready.
Yeah, half the guys couldn't care less, but I really don't want to hear anything about it until I see it. So we'll do a special episode, just Ron and I, and then everybody can listen to that one, except for Don and Al. They won't listen to that one.
Oh, I'll listen to it.
I'll listen to it.
I might learn something.
So I'm looking around, and all I see on the table are a ton of snacks and a ton of comics, like piles and piles of comic books.
I have the best pile.
You kind of do. You got a really good pile. We've got a very special episode for you today.
Speaking of special episodes, I also have a special gift.
Oh.
I have a special gift.
Is it the gift that keeps on giving?
We're doing this on air.
No, it's not. Yeah, I'm doing this on air, dude. Okay, so when we were all sitting at my house recording, right, for a little while I got real quiet on the episode because I came across something online when I was looking at Instagram.
Wait, so you were perusing the internet while you were recording episodes?
I was.
He was trying to find out because we're talking about Marvel prose books from the 70s.
Yeah, well, I was looking at prose books, and like I ended up in like an internet hole of like, you know, constantly like this link led to that link led to that link, and I found this really, really cool lapel pin. Okay, and the instant I saw it online, I almost said something, but I held it back. I shut my mouth. Because I wanted to get it as a surprise. So, I got you a little something here, Al. Okay? This is for you. All right? I saw this online, and it instantly screamed your name to me. Check this out.
Oh, my God, Baltimore. That's awesome. Oh, yeah, EC, baby.
Yeah.
So, right on, dude.
Okay, guys. So, what this is it's a lapel pin. It's a good size. It's like, what would you say, a little smaller than a 50-cent piece?
Yeah, about the same size.
Well, with the hair, it's a little bigger.
Yeah,
with the hair. This is awesome.
It's a Vault of Horror. Yeah. It's the ghoul's head. I found that thing online and it screamed your name to me, man.
It's Johnny Craig artwork. I even know that. So
he knows the issue, the panel.
Yeah, exactly.
I have been chomping at the bit.
I ordered it.
I ordered it like the next day online, and it showed up at my door.
Thank
I've been
you
dying,
so much,
dying
man.
To hand that to you. So
thank you so much. This is awesome.
We'll post pictures online for everybody to check that out. But it's
yeah,
a really cool piece.
Cool.
I like it.
It's yeah, like a zombie guy. Yeah, yep. Yeah. But he's got an earring on. I think that was added on or whatever. But that is cool.
Yeah. No, yeah, I got to tell you, these lapel pins, stuff like this is really, really popular right now. My wife and I have gotten into collecting different ones. And this particular piece with the Vault of Horror backing to it and everything, just a really, really cool piece. So I really thought you'd enjoy that.
Oh, this is awesome.
They started getting popular in the 80s because...
They're making a huge resurgence, though.
Yeah. I just embedded in myself.
Well, yeah, because the ghoul wants.
Well, it's an EC.
You know, that's how you upgrade it in rank.
Yeah,
it's blood rank.
Yeah, blood pen.
Yeah, because when I saw those in the 80s, I thought they were kind of stupid. Now I look back, I wish I would have bought the Rocketeer one. And
now, if you look at the back, it should have the what number it is out of the pressing.
Yep, 66 out of 100. Wow, it's really a limited one.
Wow. Yeah. They're usually about 100 per pressing in these lapel pins.
Wow.
So, yep. Yeah.
It should have been like 666 out of 1,000.
That would have been awesome.
Actually, I have one, but not this one. And I got it a long time ago. I think I got it at the post office. It's a back in the 90s or late 80s, they had like Universal Horror like stuff. And they had, like, I have a little pin of Dracula.
We get a picture of him here. Hold on. There we go.
That's going on the podcast. On the website.
And I also have like a whole sheet of Universal Monsters stamps from like the 80s or whatever.
Nice. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah,
man.
But this is cool,
is totally
man.
Cool.
Yeah, definitely. Wow, yeah. Look at that guy. What other styles, what other things were there?
That particular pin company, they didn't have anything else that I can well,
no superhero stuff or anything like
it's
that.
It's random. It's really random some of the stuff that I run across. Like it all got started with us ordering, like, lapel pins with Nightmare Before Christmas-style stuff on it.
Yeah.
One of the bands that my wife and I ran into have lapel pins. It's a band called Basalt Zombies. Oh, dude.
Don't mention that. I'll tell you a story after the year about that.
Basalt Zombies, though, these guys, excellent band. I got to get a hold of them and... we're gonna talk to them about playing them on the air, dude.
Oh, nice!
They're really, really cool guys.
I have some kind of like Nightmare Before Christmas character somewhere from a garage somewhere. If I do, I'll bring it. I'll give it to you. Cause it's just sitting in my
garage. Gotta make it a surprise and do it on the air, though.
Here's the pin that started it all off for my wife and I. It's Maurice from Little Monsters. The Howie Mandel movie.
That is cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. This company did like three different runs of it: a glitter run, a glow in the dark run, and the regular run. So they're a really popular thing that's going on right now, man. It's really, really neat. So, but like I said, that one I thought you'd love. So I had to get that for you.
Actually, I forgot to mention my friend who was down here, Pat, who was down here. We did a show. This is really a commitment to comic books. He actually tattooed Orion onto his arm.
Nice.
He's got like a Kirby tattoo. It took him 5 hours to put it on or whatever.
That's awesome, though.
Like, that's a commitment to comic books. So.
It's nice because it's a fairly obscure character,
too. Yeah, it's Kirby.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, it's Kirby.
It's Kirby, man. So, cool.
Look, we got a few other orders of business. I know I kind of threw everybody to the wolves by starting to record right away, so we have it. Look, everybody, we're flying by the seat of our pants right now because we didn't get to sit down and talk about what we're going to be doing. You know, we've got a couple things in mind here, but...
Yeah, right?
So, anybody have anything they want to talk about first?
Yes.
Okay.
Hash browns.
So, this horrible person came into my life. And
Drum roll, please.
Ladies and gentlemen...
Wow, there's not even any time for the rest of us.
Okay, we were going to try and plan this episode, but since it's kind of like, you know... Well,
thank God we're not doing this live.
Oh, Jesus.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't see it in the show notes, this is the Lock and Key episode.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't know that, but... Okay.
Yeah.
So, Joe Hill, and some of you may know him as Stephen King's son, I read and actually watched his book Horns. I really liked it. I liked the book. I liked the movie. And then this man over here, Rook, gave me The Lock and Key. He's like, dude, you need to read this. I'm like, okay.
Which, by the way, is yet again another recommendation from Brittany at Yancey Street Comics.
First off, you mentioned Joe Hill. We need to give a shout out to Gabriel Rodriguez, who does
an absolutely
astonishing job on the art. This book is by IDW. And so, you guys, if you haven't read it before and you're mildly interested, by the end of this episode, you're going to want to run out and get it.
Yeah, because this thing... I want to start from, like, book four, really, but I can't.
That's how Don and I started, actually. We started reading from book four.
Yeah,
they started
at book four, and they were so confused, they couldn't figure out what the hell was going on.
So we went back to book one and started...
Going back to that, I liked it, but I didn't really have any intention to read anymore. I mean, it was a good story, but I was saying some of it didn't make sense, like that character,
Dodge.
Yeah, Dodge. I was going to say Dash for some reason. But he, I couldn't quite understand why he was friends with him and he was doing something else. And then Rook said, you got to start from the beginning. Well, so he did give them to us in the beginning. And it's a completely different thing if you read it in sequence. Unless you want to be like Hash Brown and be a wild card and just throw everything out and go to four.
And it's completely satisfying reading it in sequence,
yeah,
too.
And it made me want to read it.
I pulled up a list of all the characters' faces and names in case we forget their names. So
that's good.
I got
them all
here. Pretty easy.
But that's... if this one... ordinarily, you can pick up a comic book and read it from any section and, you know, it's fine. This one, you have to read it in sequence.
Yeah, well, this is truly a story that has a start, middle, and end point to it. You know, of course, Joe Hill being the son of one of the most famous horror suspense writers in the world, he writes a story that I think can appeal to a wide variety of audience, not just horror suspense readers, but... drama, teen angst.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
This is an absolute. It's a beautiful piece of work. It's an absolute beautiful piece of work.
Well, and you can't discredit him at all because he's. You're right about, you know, you were saying drama, teen angst. One of his great strengths is his characterization. Mm-hmm. Every single character is fully formed. It's like a three-dimensional, living, breathing person.
Mm-hmm.
The dialogue is spot on.
Yeah.
The characters themselves interact so well.
Well, and let's go back to Gabriel Rodriguez for a minute. Not only are the characters the way it's written, but the keys themselves are their own characters, their own design, each one of them being so different. The keys in this series are so different and so amazingly. I mean, I know people that are getting tattoos of them collected. People are actually making physical copies of the keys.
Better than the Kingdom Heart keys.
There you go.
I like it better than my house keys. Yeah.
just to anybody who hasn't read Lock and Key. What we're
it's
talking
about locks and keys.
It's about locks and keys. Actually, the family's name is Locke. The where they live is called
L-O-C-K-E.
Key House.
L-O-C-K-E.
Where they live is called Key House. Well, Key House has...
You say that in your Canadian accent.
House.
House.
These keys open not doors, but the head key opens up, well, the head, the brain, the emotions, the ghost key opens up the door where you can walk through and become a ghost. The keys have powers, special abilities.
In the back of each of the trades, too, there's a list of all the known keys or all the keys that appear in each trade. There's six total trades. But in the back of each one, it shows all the keys that are involved in the story, and it has a little short history of the keys and says what they do. Really neat.
Where they came from, who made them.
That's right.
Because the keys have been made by different members of the family over the generations.
And Key House is an ancestral, basically a mansion. It's massive. There's a great... In one of the issues, there's a diagram of the entire mansion. But anyway, so the Locke family has been living here for generations, for literally hundreds of years, since the Revolutionary War.
Yep. Yeah,
right?
Since the time of the Revolutionary War, they've been living in this town called Lovecraft, Massachusetts.
Which is obviously a nod.
Yeah. Which, when I first picked it up, I was like, Lovecraft, Massachusetts, really? Okay, so this is really going to be like a Cthulian, kind of thing. And, I was pleasantly surprised to see that it didn't follow along that, like, so basic and idiotic of a concept. It it did acknowledge the Lovecraft concepts and built and changed the storyline, you know. So he borrowed a little Lovecraftian concept in some of these ideals and then created a whole new world amongst it.
The beauty is the execution, though.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the most complicated of plots. However, the way the story's told, the way he executes it is awesome. And it gives it so many different layers because it tells it at different points of time. They go back in time. You go to the present.
It jumps through time, present, past. No future, though.
No future.
No future. No okay. Future. So it doesn't really jump in time. But whatever. It's...
So one of the... in one of the books, real quick, because we were talking about the keys, one of the keys opens up a grandfather clock and you can literally set the time in the clock and it'll push you back in time.
Right.
And so... When you go back in time, you act like a ghost, though. The Locke children go back
you're
in time.
You're simply viewing history, able to
my
change
My view
it.
Is kind of what you just said. This whole thing is nothing but a giant history lesson for, like, the family that's growing up. It's like, this is your past, and this is how you can change and create a better future for yourself. And
now, it also borrows a bit of... excuse me. It borrows a bit of Narnian-esque writing to the fact that...
But no Mr. Tumnus.
Narnian-esque that only the kids can use the keys. Once you grow up and you're an adult, the magic stops working.
And that's because of a rule that one of the key masters made like maybe 100 years ago, right? He made a key that when you walk through... the front door as an adult, you forget.
Or
something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can't see. You know, you can still be affected by the things that the keys do.
Were you doing spoilers and everything?
Yeah, this is, if we haven't already said, this is spoiler-filled. Al, you haven't read it, have you?
No, but go ahead.
I think you just need to take that stack and hand it to Al because...
No, not yet.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You want to thumb through
them? The only thing I would say is...
I haven't seen them before.
Just don't give the ending away for the last
book. Oh, no,
book.
Absolutely not. Do not give the ending...
I mean, you can talk about the last six. Book, but just don't...
thing that happens.
Yeah.
The big thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, Billy, you were saying?
No, it's all changed.
I hijacked your mind. So, okay, so we've kind of gone over the ground rules and how it works. Let's start kind of from the beginning of the story and explain how it starts and how we get to know the Locke characters, how we meet them.
That's one thing I wanted to add on that was when we were talking about the keys. You explained about what each key did in the history and who made them. What I liked about it was when the story starts, they have these keys and the kids are talking about. One of them said, I even heard there's a key that would turn you into a girl. And I thought, why would you even want that? But then as I read the story at the end, when the guy explained why he made it, I thought, well, that makes perfect sense.
Yes.
And some of those keys seem bizarre and random to me about why you would have them, what's the purpose of it. But
they're dropping hints all the time about those keys. Like, for instance, the one about turning into a girl, they might mention it in the first trade, but you don't see that executed until, I think, the fourth trade.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then, interestingly enough, the uncle, their uncle.
Rendell?
Yeah.
No, that's the dad, right? Rendell's the dad.
The uncle is Dunk.
Duncan.
You know, Dodge makes this comment to him about how he always used to love to use the gender key when he was little.
Well, he did.
Well, it's because he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and you don't find out till maybe book three or something like that.
Which you don't. You don't find out about the uncle till later, and you kind of like, he was using the gender key and everything because he's more comfortable as you know.
Yeah.
So it was a really neat way to deal with. Concepts of homosexuality and transgender by pointing out the gender key and the uncle's usages of it.
Yes,
I thought it was a neat little thing that
the
he'd
skin
done
color
in a non
the skin
way.
Color key
that was powerful.
That was a very powerful commentary right there. The skin color key.
That's one thing when Dunk the uncle at one point in the story when he's in grave trouble and he's dressed. You know, he's a little girl. That's one that stays with me, was he's hiding at the banister, hiding for his life. And I don't know why my heart went out to him seeing he's a girl and he's just so, you know, I mean, he's going to die. It kind of got me because they weren't comic book characters anymore. They were real, you know, flesh and blood characters.
Mm-hmm. And that's the strength, I think, of Joe Hill's writing.
Yeah.
Is you
absolutely
really feel for these characters.
Well, just for example, Horns, I cried like a baby at the end of that book.
cry like a baby during Jurassic Park.
Last time I saw Rook, I gave him back the last lock and key. And one thing I said to it was, there's different types of writing styles. And there's a lot of different types of writers I like. But some writers, what I like about it is how they put the story together. You know, how they arrange the story.
Mm-hmm.
I also like some stories, like the Harry Potter, you know, series, talking about regular prose books, is they're kind of like puzzles and how they all unfold and how they tie in together. And Lock and Key was a lot of it. But it's in the last book, at one point, where some of the characters are surprised about how they're acting. And the punk guy, the one with the shaved head and the bald, you know, all the tattoos.
Hold on. Let me. I forgot his name, but I'll pull it up.
Hold on. Give me a second.
Scott.
Damn.
I was rooting for you, Hash Brown. I was rooting for you. But,
Billy, pass those out a little bit so they're not just all stacked in front of you.
Well, that's intimidating.
Okay, so, but you were saying...
I was talking about that character was at the end, I was thinking, why would he do that? Because he was aware of what he was doing. And finally, and not spoiling anything, but finally at the end, when he opened up and explained why. And I was telling Rook, that's one thing about this writing, was he's able to construct a story, you know, have the whole puzzle kind of thing. But he was able to express a human element that everybody could relate to. And just in one word balloon. I mean, it was a long word balloon. But he told it quite simply.
Is that when he was talking to the class? Or to like a group of people?
No, it was at the end when he's in that cavern.
Yeah, when they're in the cavern.
It's at the end.
It's been a while.
And it's okay. It's been a while for me too. But it really got me. But it was a perfect example. It wasn't what they call a MacGuffin, where at the very end they have some little wild card that explains why everybody did it and everybody's mm-hmm. okay now. But I really fell for it, and I thought, it's sometimes you talk about things like feelings of deja vu. You always wonder why you felt that way, like you don't remember it, but for some reason you do. And he was explaining about why, and they said, well, it wasn't your fault. And he says, no, it was my fault. And he told me why, and I thought, man, he's a writer on different levels. And then Rook said, oh, you got to read this. And he handed me Horns. I'm almost finished with it. I was trying to finish it before we all got together. The guy can write.
Oh, man.
He writes good comic books, but he can write great novels. He really paints a picture with words, and he...
I honestly feel that Scott Hill, to me, is a better writer than his father.
He had the benefit of probably being mentored by his father and being around him.
That's true.
Well, so, and you were talking about puzzle pieces. He's great at, just looking at Lock and Key, he's great at writing the long-form story that it really pays off by the time, if you read it from the beginning to end, it pays off by the time you finish the book. But it also works episodically, because these were single issues when they were released. There was, 36 issues? And each issue generally has some sort of a resolution.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
With the cliffhanger. So, you know, he even though he's writing for the trade, per se, or writing for the long-form story, each issue in and of itself can be read and, you know, appreciated.
Yeah.
Which is kind of difficult to do.
Well, you know, the Locks are such a broken family when we start, when we walk into this story, the Locks are such a broken family, destroyed by, I mean, an absolutely horrific act of violence. There's not much that you think that he could do to them to tear them apart, to bring them down. And instead you find out that there's a whole list of horrific things that he could do.
You're referring to the villain.
Dodge.
Well, yeah. I'm referring to the writer.
Oh, okay.
You know, and Dodge as well. I mean, Dodge is quite the son of a bitch, shall we say.
Yeah, a couple parts I thought I was reading a George R. R. Martin, but...
Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you. Right? Telling you. Well, it's like, okay, he's dead. Oh, they're dead.
No, we're not taking a break yet.
All right.
How long have we been talking?
25 minutes.
Well, let's talk another 5-10 minutes, and then we'll have a break.
Don just grabbed me by my shirt collar and lifted me a foot off the
fourth wall break.
This is funny.
Right?
I love
the Squadron Strange.
Okay, now that's... Go ahead.
I wish they had explained something more with there, because there was so much of like a hinting towards him being like a part of the key system itself.
Who are you talking about?
The Rufus. Rufus.
Yes. That's 2-0, Ash Browns. 2-0, man. You let me down. You're letting me down. I'm rooting for you, and you're letting me down every time.
Sorry, there's just so many characters, and they're all trying to like flip through my brain at one time right now. But there's, you know, I wish that there had been a key like for him to kind of almost explain like that he is the way that he is for the reason, and not just it just so happens to be.
He becomes such an important character, a strong character in his own right, and you would never
expect He's like Neville Longbottom in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look at this geeky kid. Oh,
well, that's one thing I enjoyed in this section Al's talking about was there's two different boys in it, and they're playing with action figures, but not just action. One has a big gorilla doll.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what I did when I was a kid. I'd have little plastic army men, little cereal toys, Major Matt Mason figures, you know. None of them are the same size or scale, and to me, it was just a magical time that is in my mind to this day. And it was your own world. You'd play in the floor, play in the corner, play on the table, and that's what they were doing. And what I liked was the one boy is a little bit older, and I guess he's autistic. Is that what the issue is?
Yes. Yeah.
And he came over the sister to watch. The sister introduces him to her little brother, who was again playing with, you know, different action figures and stuff. And she introduces it like it's a military operation. And immediately the two boys are in character. They face each other holding all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one's more talking in a British accent, one's more American. I absolutely love that. And that goes on all the way through the story after that. There's a lot of layers and depth to this.
Well, here you go. Another strength of Joe Hill's. The children don't talk like little adults. They actually
They sound like kids.
They act and talk like kids.
Yeah, but absolutely. It's kind of, you know, scary in the same aspect. Because, you know, yes, he's talking in that, you know, oh, I'm a soldier and these are my men and everything like that. But what he's saying, once you realize that, oh, it's not just a bunch of gibberish, that there's actual thought behind it, and you start looking at what he's saying, it's like, whoa, this kid knows way more than what he should.
Well, that's the great part is, when you first see him, you might kind of dismiss him.
I completely did.
Yeah, and I think you're supposed to, because that's what everybody else in the story's doing. But then, when you're forced to read more about him and understand his plight or where he's coming from, then you understand him a little more. Yeah, which I think is a brilliant,
fantastic.
He's definitely an easily overlooked element. And once you realize his importance, that's when you're like, oh crap, okay.
Yeah, because he's been around since either the first or second book.
Yeah.
Probably second book. But kind of in the background for a while. And then he starts to slightly build in importance. And you realize he's a fairly important character. And that's a great thing. There's no one single hero or one single main character in this story. Everybody's incredibly important. Everybody plays their own part.
And it's...
One thing that always surprised me in that book is you want your characters to make it through okay. I mean, you don't want to see anybody hurt or die or mutilated. And a lot of times the comics I read, and I'm talking a scope of, you know, from the 60s all the way up to now, like when reading the X-Men, when Storm was in Japan and, you know, shaved her long hair off and had a mohawk and just went kind of berserk, that was staggering at the time. You want your characters to stay intact. In this book, I was kind of horrified at what he did to some. Well, as the thing went on to almost everybody. But it wasn't like it was a big carnage at one point. I mean, it's slowly chipping away and sometimes destroying somebody, you know, breaking them down. And then some of the horrific things he did, and they were long term. They were horrifying. And I was thinking towards the end, how is this going to end? I mean, honestly. And I was surprised at the ending. And it was bittersweet, but, you know, really strong.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic ending. But yeah, the villain, man, you hate him with a passion because of the things he does. You really, you grow to hate this guy.
Man, you wish for it.
Yeah, you do, but at the same time, and when they start showing later what he was like in the past, I mean, he was a great human being.
Yes.
And he gives you a glimmer of hope for Dodge.
Yes.
Only to tear it away and destroy it.
Especially a very crucial part near the end of the book when he's with his old girlfriend, Ellie.
Yeah.
Well, brutal, you know, man. the the thing that killed me is the hope that they give to Dodge, that he gives Dodge at one point to maybe be a decent human being and a decent person. And it just, it's so late in the series that I figured, okay, well, you know, this is how it's going to end. They're all going to team up and they're all going to vanquish this evil together. And then Dodge just turns around and turns into an a-hole again. So,
oh my God, yeah.
You know.
Well, that's one thing is towards the end of the book, which, you know, we're not going to spoil, but it happens to some of the other characters too, and it surprises me because these are characters I really cared for and liked. I mean, really enjoyed, and they were all vastly different, just like regular life. And I was surprised at how they were acting after certain things happened.
Well, yeah, but that was Dodge's influence.
Yeah, it was Dodge's influence.
Mm-hmm.
But
then, it was all Dodge again, that did that.
That's what I was talking about, the explanation at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Is this six books? Six volumes?
Six volumes, yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, this is something, it's something I always bring up all the time is, sometimes you tell somebody about a storyline you liked, and you know, like say a Wolverine storyline or something, you can get the trades, but sometimes the trades don't finish with the same creative team. It's always broken.
Mm-hmm.
This is six complete volumes, same creative team all the way through. It's consistent,
incredibly consistent.
Yeah, and it's worth having. I read my friend's copies. Thank you very much. But
thank
you. Yeah, but
thanks for.
But it's nice to have. And if you liked it, it's not like it's going to be really enjoying for a few and then bone-crushing disappointment towards the end because something bad happened, you know, as far as creators go.
No, this is like a really amazing movie, too, where,
yeah.
You know, you watch it the first time. Well, I know that I'm going to have to read this again just to find all the things that I missed.
Well, the fourth
book, I would attribute to that because I had a second read-through about 6 or 7 months ago. Yeah. And
there was talk of
so
turning this into a movie or TV series.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Absolutely. It would be, but it won't be better than a comic book.
Mm. No, absolutely not.
Mainly because I think with that, or in the volumes, volume 2, just Mind Games. I actually did read that one twice.
Yes.
Just because...
Well, it's actually called Head Games, so there you go.
Or Head Games.
Well, yeah, but it gives you mind... I was going to say, it's playing mind games with you.
When, you know, they first opened up the head, and I'm like, whoa, okay, he has an empty head. That's kind of weird, but then... They looked into it, and they're like, when you're looking into Bode's head, and you're seeing things, and you like start going through, and it's almost like a Where's Waldo of, okay, I've read this part, I've read this part, there's actually a little bit of foreshadowing through some of it, and it's like, whoa, and then you just, you know, they keep with the... You know, the head games, because the head key just is so important throughout everything.
You're right. And this head, basically, it's a head key. And I want to say that, is it Bodhi that finds it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bodhi finds them all. If it's every generation, one of the children always
finds
it. Gotcha.
So that's
why
he finds them all. So it's a head key.
He doesn't find all the keys, but he finds some of the most important keys.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
The most important key actually... ends up being
the Omega.
Oh yeah.
How great a foreshadowing was that?
So good.
Uh-huh.
So,
do you remember that, Don?
Just keep talking.
Yeah. You know, for that all important key to be hidden in such plain sight throughout the whole goddamn series was just mind blowing.
So okay, we're gonna take a break in just a second here.
Don.
But first, I just wanted to elaborate the head key, which we were just talking about, is one of the greatest keys in the book because you basically whenever the head key is in proximity. If you take a look at the panel, anytime you can see the back of somebody...
If you backtrack through, you'll notice that...
There's an opening like...
There's a key opening in the back
of
their head.
There's a keyhole in the back of everybody's neck whenever they're around
it. I actually had to go back and look.
So basically...
The very first panel that he's holding the head key, he has a keyhole in his head.
Yes. So when you put this in the back of your head, you turn it, and the top half of your head just... Or, you know, above your eyebrows is gone. And it's pretty much flat. And everyone around you can kind of look in.
Yeah.
They can visually, physically see your memories, your fears.
You can as well.
You can.
That's the weirdest part.
If you're suddenly beside yourself. Yes.
You're suddenly beside yourself, third person, looking into your own friggin' skull. That's
so you
weird.
Can take out memories. You can take out, for instance, Kinsey takes out her fear. So she
crying.
Has no more fear. And and she can't cry anymore.
Oh, and
so
of course,
she takes those emotions out of her head. And so she physically can't do those.
Bottle.
Yeah,
well, that's something that Rook had talked about way back when we were bringing this up, was the head key I didn't really pay much attention to it, but you know, when the key would show up, you would see the keyhole. But I didn't really always notice it until after I read the story.
I did what Rook did, and I went back and like every instance in the older issues, I'd be like, yeah. "It's there, it's there, it's there."
Yeah. But there were some others, like when she took the fear and the crying out, you know, and put them in a Coke bottle. Those things, I thought, Mike, you can't get by in life without that.
No, and she doesn't.
And she doesn't realize
it. But then later, it looked like they were gone. They were destroyed or gone. And then later on in the book, they brought something up because she was afraid. And they said, I thought it was gone. Because well, I don't think those things really ever go away. She said something far more poetic than what I'm pushing right now.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, this series, it's so in-depth, it's so rich. And it says, we could sit there and read it to you page by page.
Which we will after break.
But it's not, even so, if we did do that, and even told you the ending, which we all agreed not to, if you bought it and read it, you'd still read a far better story than what we would be reading to you. And it's something, it's multiple reads. You can continually read it, and it's going to be fantastic every time.
All right, guys, we'll be back after this.
And I You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And we're back.
And that was The Home We Made Part 2 from Cry Wolf. That song was actually my soundtrack. That his album, The Ghosts, The Ghosts EP, was the soundtrack that I listened to while reading through Lock and Key. And that particular song really kind of kept resonating through my head the whole time reading this book. So go back, listen to that song, read the books. You know, that's kind of the spot I was in.
Very appropriate. So, I like how you made it very thematic. You brought it all back together.
There you go.
The music.
That was my Lock and Key soundtrack, that song.
So, I want to apologize to our listeners this episode. Not that it's any worse than any other episode, but we have a table full of food here. I mean, we got cookies, chips.
I feel like I'm in the movie theater. Every time I'm trying to go for something, it's like crinkle, crinkle.
I know. So if you guys are hearing all these random sounds in the background, it's just us trying to be quiet, but it's not going to happen. Exactly.
So,
hey, it's not as bad as the pistachio episode, where I was sitting there eating pistachios, and you could hear the shells dinking into the cup every couple seconds.
You know what? Don't do that. So...
All right, so are we still on Lock and Key?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah.
All right,
you want to continue?
Next book episode four. Is the Al Val episode. I'm just telling you guys.
All right, so book four, Keys to the Kingdom.
Can I say how brilliant chapter one is, because it's an homage to Bill Watterson, all Calvin and
Hobbes.
Okay,
is that what it was?
Yes,
I'm like
all Calvin and Hobbes.
Wait,
I didn't mean to hijack.
Is that what it was?
I know it's Calvin and Hobbes.
You're being thrown out. Oh, wait, that's what it was supposed to be?
Talk to the hand. No more.
Hash Brown's
dead.
You can't look at that and know it's Calvin and Hobbes.
I know it's Calvin and Hobbes, but I'm just sitting there going like,
"No,
I like this, but this is weird." And then I'm thinking it's going to be going on to something else. And it's like, wait, no, it just kind of stops there. And it's.
I love it, though, because whenever every other page is Calvin, like, there's two pages of Calvin and Hobbes style artwork, and then two pages of standard artwork. The Calvin and Hobbes style artwork is all from Bodhi, the youngest Locke child. It's from his perspective.
Yes, and how appropriate. I mean, he is such a Calvin-esque character, truthfully. So, and the keys are his Hobbes.
Those pages are played comically, too. Like, he's becoming an animal, and he's having fun talking to other birds. The thing is, when you're reading it just straightforward, those two pages, you're like, oh, it's kind of a funny cartoon. Like, he's a bird and he's talking to the birds. But that's
and
really
Dr.
happening.
Jekyll and Mr.
Yeah,
Hyde.
But
it's
get,
really happening.
Get,
he really is because of the
you
key.
Get the Bodhi pages, and then you get the older sibling pages where it's like horrific and blood and just
and
guts. And
real
then the Bodhi
visceral.
Pages again. You know, it's
it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm pretty sure Don and I talked about that in the podcast before.
Well, and that's why you lent it to me, because it had that Calvin Hobbes look. One thing Bill Watterson always talked about was people, whenever they do child strips, they always do it like it's all precious, and it's all sentimental. And he says that's not really what childhood's like. Childhood has scary times, has horrifying times. I mean, at its best. And I thought that's exactly right. So even though you're seeing this and it's the fun cartoon stuff and all that, there is a threat underlying going all the way through.
There really is.
It's nice. Again, number four is not the one that you want to read first.
I just told Don to talk louder.
Four is probably the most powerful of it because, for one, it starts with the Calvin and Hobbes, and then it goes into the color key. As we were just talking about earlier, the color key is such a powerful statement. The skin color chain, the skin color key. Mm-hmm. And it's also part where we learn some very nasty things about, our characters.
It's nice commentary on African Americans in our culture.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. This entire book, this is probably the pinnacle where everything...
Yes. The one you're thumbing through right now, this chapter, I don't know if you're still there, I think it's called February.
February.
And every page is a different day of the month.
Yep.
And you'll see like a little calendar picture in the corner and it'll say what day it is, And so you see like a day in the life of all these characters, and it's like fast moving, but just so fun.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah.
Well, and it's like the really messed up stuff that happens, you know. And a lot of keys are discovered in this month as well. The Wing Key, the Hercules Key, the Chain Key, you know, what other keys?
I feel like the Hercules Key was found in book three, but...
Was it?
Tyler uses it in this one. Mm-hmm. Right, because in book three, he uses the key to fight something.
The shadow.
Shadow creature.
The shadow, that's right.
Explain to me.
The giant key. Yeah. Bodhi and his friend playing with the giant key. They're giants.
Yeah, that's great.
Picking up cars and tractors.
You're playing cars? Someone's going to see you.
Bodhi, what are you doing? Playing cars? I stepped on your gazebo. Oh, man.
This scene, too, there's one picture that's like straight homage to Professor Xavier as a jerk.
Yeah.
That famous Paul Smith page with Kitty Pryde.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
there's
man.
Just a ton of just very vague homages to different things and like nods off to things in pop culture and comic books everywhere throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
Really brilliant.
Oh yeah. Oh, and the all important I almost threw out my dad's hat scene.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I used to go back digging through the garbage for it.
You know.
Yeah, there's so many little things. So many.
So should we kind of run through just a really quick overview of the story, start to finish?
Sure.
Without spoiling the ending, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off, you know, we've already talked about the Locke family, but the story itself with book one starts with the murder of Rendell Locke, who's the father of the family. And he's killed. He's a guidance counselor.
Mm-hmm. At a high school.
And he's,
at the high school his son goes to.
That's right. His son and daughter both go to this high school. And one of the kids that he was that was constantly seeing him, a student of his, ends up murdering him.
Sam.
Yeah, Sam. Basically in front of his family, and they cripple his wife.
Damn near rape her.
Yeah,
do they damn near or do they?
I think
rape
they
her.
Do rape her.
I think they did.
It's implied. It's not shown.
Yeah, I don't remember.
So it starts with this huge catastrophe, like just this huge thing that happens to the family, and it's the death of the father, and then because he passed away, because he died, they want to the kids that there were two kids that that attacked and murdered the father, they're put away, right?
One of them dies. One is killed, and the other is put away.
The other one, his name's Sam Lesser. Yeah, he's put away. He's in prison. But because the father died, the entire family is moved to Lovecraft, Massachusetts, to the family mansion. And that's really where the story starts. So the murder of their father is kind of the catalyst for it. Once they get to the mansion, it shows the two older kids, Kinsey and Tyler, kind of getting acclimated to their new school, making new friends, meeting new teachers, learning their story. Meanwhile, Bodhi, the youngest one, who I've got to say is probably like 9, 10 years old, I don't know if it's ever said, he starts finding these random keys around the mansion. So, of course, it turns out all of these keys have significance. They do all these things that we've been talking about before the music break. And from there, you find out there's a person who calls himself Dodge that is trying to get these keys and one specific key called the Omega Key. And he'll do anything in his power to get it. And so Dodge is the villain of the piece, and he basically just messes with everybody trying to get that key, and shenanigans ensue.
Shenanigans.
In a nutshell, that's how the story starts. That's how it continues, and it's
now, is that the end of the whole story?
Yeah, yeah, there's only six volumes. It's got a definitive
middle and end. And that's one of the things I actually really like about it. Is it definitively ended?
Yeah.
It could go on,
but I don't feel it.
I don't think this story
has been told.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is no going back to this story and adding in. You know, if you're to see any future to the Lock and Key series, I think it's going to be the kids.
Yeah.
You know, but I really hope they don't. I really hope that Hill and Rodriguez held all of the ownership over this to ensure that no one else F's up this series.
Yeah.
So. You know, we've been talking so much about the story and about Joe Hill, and man, we've got to talk about that art.
Yeah.
Oh, the artwork is God. Well, I mean, we were just talking about the Calvin and Hobbes homage.
You're right. But
I mean, and I mentioned Hill's absolutely brilliant design of the keys, but his characters are
Rodriguez.
Jeez, I'm dense.
His characters are great. The good thing is he is consistent as hell. Like, a character looks the same from start to finish.
You get some artists
that all the female characters or all the child characters all kind of look like each other. Not so much here. Now, he's got a very distinct style.
Yeah.
But each character looks very distinct and they don't change. Like, yeah. You always know who you're looking at and who's who, what you, what's happening.
Yeah.
I also liked what he did with, yes, I guess I'm always going back to head games. This, even though someone can look at the same person, in their heads, it looks completely different. Like, how Bode viewed the woman in the well is completely different than everybody else's.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, so when you're going through and seeing all this, you know, even though it's not said, it's drawn, and it's just so, like,
speaking
impactful.
Speaking of the well, too, the architecture in general is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, the backgrounds are fully fleshed out. The architecture, the key house looks the same all the time. I have a feeling that Rodriguez drew a 2 or 3 dimensional schematic or a map, an idea of exactly what Key House looks like, where everything is, similar to what Gerhard would do for Cerebus. You know, he'd draw out everything.
I really think a lot of this was planned and mapped out and built by the two of them before anything was started.
Yes.
So that they knew, you know that the house sits here, the garden is here, the gazebo, the pool. Mm. The caves underneath.
Because nothing's arbitrary.
No. Nothing, you know where someone is at all times. Once you understand, I think it's probably the first or second volume. Once you understood the layout of Key House, you understood where everybody was and why nobody saw this happen or why everybody saw that happen.
That place was huge.
The place is huge, mm-hmm. but you know they give you a definitive concept of where everything is. Mm-hmm. You know
that is
where
true.
The ghost door is. You know that the ghost door is in this particular part of the house and opens to outside.
Yes, opens out to like the back or like a garden.
And that goes straight into the well house.
Into the well house, right. Like you always know it's where everything is at. You know where you're at.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many comic books I read as a kid, and X-Men is one. And I know I'm going to feel foolish saying this to you two because of your X-Men Mansion booklet. But I never, when I said I would love the comics, but I never had any idea of the mansion.
Well, because the mansion was always changing, too.
Yeah.
I mean, for God's sakes, the thing got blown up every other week.
Oh, yeah, looking
for it. But I'm talking about in the past, in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't really any planned layout. It was just there, mm-hmm. and you knew it. And also Avengers Mansion. It was just a big house, and you'd be in there, and none of the rooms ever seemed the same.
I think the real difference between something like that and this, the house itself is actually
a
character.
The story.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's almost like, like you said, Billy.
So if you don't have the character development of the house as well with the characters themselves and the keys, you know, even the inanimate objects, you know, there has to be that much of a character development through them.
Well, and also you're talking about the same creative team through all of this. Yeah. Versus Marvel changing out the creative teams constantly. Yeah.
And different interpretations of
this. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, everybody was fine with the Avengers Mansion, you know, or the X-Mansion changing to suit the storyline.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't uncommon because, like I said, the damn things got blown up every other week.
I'll say that I like the stories I read. I'm not putting that down. I'm just saying, one thing about Gabriel Rodriguez, the drawing is solid. His finishing style is fantastic.
My God, it is.
But you know, it's a lot of work to sit there and try to do a story and just doing character design alone. But those keys, very immaculate.
Oh, yeah,
everyone,
the keys are amazing.
It wasn't like he just had a stock key design and just kind of varied a little bit.
But that's also why
each
I
one's
like
a piece
Omega
of art.
Omega key, because it was so simple in its design, but it's like the power that this thing has.
But the action figures the boys played with, the wheelchairs the people had in that one hospital, everything he did was like that was the most important thing he drew, and that was all the way through it.
You're absolutely right. Going back just real quick to the house, I was going to say, because you were looking through book 3, Crown of Shadows, it's important to know where everything is in the house, because you'll know then when they're, how far they are from escaping the house when they're attacked by all the shadow creatures.
Yep.
Like, very important to know, oh, now they're in the kitchen, so they're almost here, and what have you. So, yeah, the mansion's so important.
Well, even the key cards that Rook keeps referring to all the time, it's still his style, and you can tell it's his style, but he made them a little more.
And they were so
Middle
cool,
Ages type.
Because the cards, and every single one, the Omega key is there.
Yeah.
It's just burned, and you're like, okay, what can I see from what's not burned right now?
Yeah, which
I
is
never
great,
thought about that. You're right.
You're right, because in the back of each trade, it's got, like we were saying earlier, it's got a list of keys, but they have like almost small little, they almost look like a trading card or a small scroll with a picture.
and
in the explanation, but some of the scrolls are like burnt, or some of the parts are crossed out.
That reminds me of role playing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That area.
Yeah, this right here, the key cards. Well, and you also have to understand.
I mean, it's just a giant game of Dungeons and Dragons. They just are actually able to act out what they're imagining.
That's what I was thinking, but I wasn't. I didn't know. It seems like it, yeah.
Well, and
the repercussions are a little more dangerous than
that. Yeah, they're real.
The craftsmanship of the keys, you know, changes depending on how.
The key maker.
Because there's been different key makers over time. Mm. You know, it's. It's just, and the listing of the keys, the known keys from the diary of Benjamin Locke, and then you jump forward and the excerpts from the journal of Harlan Locke, you know, the 1800s versus the 1700s, you know, different people make different keys over different time frames for different needs. So
I want to know who built the owl key, because it's only in like maybe three frames, yeah. But
which one was that in?
Book four.
Was it in book four?
Isn't it just one? No. It wasn't the February panel?
It's in, I think it's shown in the February panel, but then it's not actually used until book six.
Oh, okay.
And all it does is just fly to the window and tap on it, and they're like, oh, look, there's that. We should probably go somewhere. But that's it.
Well, that's the beauty of it, too, because there's a lot of keys like that, even though they're fully fleshed out, you only see them for a very short time in the book,
mm-hmm.
which is great. Just that builds on the universe that they're trying to convey. It just feels that much more realistic. There's a ton of keys.
I have ideas for keys right now that, you know, just I shouldn't be allowed to be able to build them.
And that's why you're not.
Well, and the gesture key, what was that one for? I don't even remember.
I don't know.
I love the music box key is like my favorite. So there's this great music box.
That one. What the hell was that key? The gesture key.
No idea.
I don't remember what that one was for.
No idea. Trust me, I looked.
Yeah.
So there's a music box key, and basically Dodge uses it to... And basically it's a knife.
It's time to have some fun.
Exactly.
Take the knife, stick it in someone.
It basically opens a little music box. There's like a little statue of a ballerina spinning around, and it's singing. And what it's singing, whoever hears it, the listener has to obey it, which is great. So it tells you to kill somebody, or it tells you to freeze and not move, which is what Dodge does to Tyler.
The thing is he used the music box gets used several times,
mm-hmm.
and you know the first time, of course, it's horrific. You know they're trying to fight it and everything. The second time, the song that I just sang, you know, the brothers both have earmuffs on, and the sister's got the knife, and you know
it's
so
almost done.
They get into this routine of figuring out, you know, okay,
and it does start to become a routine for them where it's just okay. We go to school, we fight bad guys. We go to school, we fight bad guys.
But the way it's shown is never. It's never routine to where it's never boring to watch because it's all done non-ironically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's... Oh, God. I want to talk about Alpha Omega so bad. I mean, not talking about the last chapter is killing me. I mean,
well,
how much can we talk about here and not ruin it for people?
Well, it's one thing we talked about before. We brought this up with Rook, and we haven't read the sixth one. And he kept saying, I can't tell you haven't read the last one. So what we're trying to do is, even though we're talking about it, we're kind of, no matter how much you talk, you're not going to cover everything on it.
But if
you do read it, you don't want to really spoil the ending.
It's like those old video game magazines like Nintendo Power where they'd show you almost the entire game except for the last dungeon boss.
Yeah. I mean, this whole bit at the end with the caves.
All right. I will say something kind of about the end, but not really.
Do we need a spoiler?
No. Just how the magic that is supposed to be contained in these keys can sometimes be bent or broken. Because when you look at the mom, you know, severe alcoholic at this point, and going absolutely crazy. The time when she was in the bathroom and she found the mending cabinet and all the plates she had broken
and all of that.
And, you know, she's trying to do that and she's going through all of that. It's like, okay, yes, you don't see the magic, but now you're able to, and it's like, you know, when they, like, it was figured out then, but not till the end do, you know, you really even come to terms with it, but it's just amazing, like, what they did, and when the mom I don't know. I guess she was just, and in her alcoholic form, just kind of reverted to a child and was able to kind of see the magic again, maybe type thing. But when she was able to see Bode in ghost form.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I think it was only when she was drunk, right?
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Because when she was sober, nothing was...
That's right. I forgot that she saw Bode.
So I don't know. There was so much on there that I'm, like, I would read, and then I would just have to put the book down and, like, just think about it, go through the other books, yes. Back flip a little bit.
Right? Yeah, yeah. I think we all probably had to do that, kind of go back and forth with some of the books.
I did, too.
Yeah.
As far as the keys, what you guys are talking about, I just kind of read through them, brushed over, and never really cared too much about it. I could see where the keys came from and why they came about, because that was a question I had when I was reading it. Like, again, the key where they turn you into girls. So why would you even want something like that? Well, then you find out why. But as far as, I didn't realize that different people were making them. I thought it was that one guy that made all of them. Mm-hmm. But that's what I see. These things, they're something and you can constantly read and you can find something out every time. It's a really in-depth, complete work.
And it's so rewarding. I can't say that enough.
Yeah. Mm.
By the time you finish, you're like, wow, that was just
yeah,
a fantastic
when I put
read.
When I put the last one down, I was just like, oh.
Right?
Done.
Yeah, exactly. And I have to say, I liked all the characters in it, but I can't think of his name, the boy that was autistic, absolutely turned into my favorite character.
Mm-hmm.
Rufus, that's what it was.
And I even liked the name. I can't believe I forgot it. But no, he's far and beyond... to me, my favorite character in it. But it makes you think about things that you never thought about before, see things that you may not have noticed. It's really something.
And I kind of sometimes I was reading and I would look back into my own imagination as a kid and teenager and things like that, because, you know, I played Magic the Gathering, Dungeons and Dragons, so I had an imagination.
Back when you were a little girl like Kinsey and just going through everything.
And, oh, man, it was... Some of it was almost like memory lane, like he was... in my own imagination at some times.
Oh, so, are we going to ask that question on this show or the next show?
What's that?
The question.
The question
that you had.
Oh, about
what book?
Your son.
Oh.
Should we wait for the next
We can do it at the
let's
end
do,
of this
let's
one.
Let's do the next episode. Okay. Let's do it the next episode.
Well, that's a teaser because I think we're about out of time anyway. So, look, we've got something big planned for next episode. It'll be kind of fun. You know, we've got a few things we want to talk about. But
extra special announcement that we just found out today.
That's right.
So, you'll have to wait a week.
Yeah. Okay, so overall, I think we're all in agreement that Lock and Key's fantastic and Al should read it.
As we say that, as I just handed Al the next two volumes of Nailbiters.
Oh, Nailbiters.
Yeah. That wasn't bad. I read the first
one. Prepare to be annoyed, Al, because it's not done yet. It's gonna keep going.
So this book is still being published.
Still going.
Good for them. Good for them.
Yep.
That means it's popular.
Yep.
All right, guys. Well, let's wrap it up then. Any last words about Lock and Key?
Buy it. Read it. Love
it. Read it. Read it.
Sometimes you would say it's like, why would you build this key? Gender swap. Imagine you and your wife. And one day, you know what? You get bored. It's like, you know what? I'm going to be the wife, you be the husband, and boom, there you go.
That doesn't appeal to me whatsoever.
You thought about that a lot, haven't you?
I had some ideas with those scenes.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of hash browns.
Hey, you know what? I have ideas, and they seem good to me, and other people, that's why they...
But like I say, I like the key, when I'm saying why would they build it, but then they tell you why, and you think, well, that's a perfect reason why you'd build that. It's just something
everything
I
is logical.
Yeah, but at
the
present,
I can take the logical and turn it illogical and make you just go, you know what, don't make this key.
That's your beauty.
There's logic to everything. It's just you may not have the perspective to see why it is at the point. But, you know, later on you might.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's I think we're all in agreement. It's something I highly recommend to anybody.
I think anybody who reads.
And this is something I wouldn't have touched. If I would have went in the store and none of you guys would tell me about it,
you know, it's the funny
I never
thing,
would have picked it up.
The first time I ever read, this was years ago, I picked up, I want to say either my mom or my brother got me a gift card to Yancey Street.
Mm.
This was maybe, 3 or 4 years ago. I don't even remember, maybe not at all. Anyway, I got a gift card to Yancey Street. And so I picked up maybe a preacher trade. And I'm like, all right, I have X amount of dollars left on this card. What am I going to get? Thumbing through it, I'm like, oh, this looks neat. And I picked up Volume 4, Lock and Key. Thumbed through it, I'm like, this art's fantastic. So I picked it up, and man, never turned back since then. There you go.
It is.
It
good.
Was on a whim, though. I mean, I don't think I would have just
now. And
it up.
Keep in mind, they have the Masters collection as well, which collects all of these and collects the covers as well into one volume too. So there's a variety of different collected versions of this: the hard covers, the soft covers.
I like and then these ones the master because of collected. All the artworks in the back of
yeah.
them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
I prefer this one too because one big giant volume, it just gets to be too cumbersome.
Well, it's not one big giant volume, it's actually broken up into bits.
Oh, okay.
But it comes with some very special additives to it.
You can,
so.
It's a.
This is from IDW Press.
There you go.
If anybody's looking for that.
Yeah, go. You can go on their website, or it's a popular enough book that you'll find it at pretty much any LCS.
Get it on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amazon, LCSs.
There you go.
Get it.
All right, well, thank you, everyone. Thanks, guys, for joining us. Hash Browns has one more episode with us before he moves. Okay,
yep.
So you guys can look forward to that next week. All right, thanks everybody, and take care of yourselves. We'll have another episode out in about a week, and until then,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops.